91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we visit with a young woman who's endured highly stacked odds against her to become not only successful and well-adjusted, but a widely read and acclaimed author and an advocate and activist for adoption. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We'll visit with Ashley Rhodes Corder. Born to a single addicted teen mother, she entered Florida's foster care system at age 3, spent years living in 14 different homes, some abusive, and adopted at age 12 by a stable, loving couple where she shed her cocoon to some extent. In 2003, the New York Times published her award-winning essay, which detailed her adoption day, which expanded into a best-selling book. She now has a master's degree and a second book called Three More Words. She travels widely as an advocate for kids. We'll hear from her in minutes after the news.
It's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. This hour we visit with a young woman who's a bit older when it comes to life experienced. 30 years ago, Ashley Rhodes Corder was born to a single mother. Authorities took her into Florida foster care.
She moved between 14 foster parents over 10 years. Some were abusive. At age 12, she was adopted by the Corders and began to excel in school and athletics. At age 14, she advocated for kids in the child welfare system.
Later, she won a New York Times essay contest, and that was the start of a book called Three Little Words. And she has a master's degree in social work. And at age 26, with very little funding, ran for the Florida Senate.
And she did much better than
That's
expected.
Right.
She has her own nonprofit and has written a sequel to her first book. It's called Three More Words. And Ashley Rhodes Corder joins us now from St. Petersburg, Florida. Welcome to you, Ashley.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Hi, it's great to have you. Congratulations on your new book, as difficult as that is to read, I must say.
Thank you. Yeah, and I think this new book feels almost more vulnerable than the first book because it's so fresh and so recent, and it's my life right now. Three Little Words was all about growing up in foster care and, you know, kind of the little girl and my childhood experiences, but Three More Words is so much about my current adult life. So it definitely felt a little more vulnerable to put it out there. It's about, you know, my life now and how I met my husband and what's happening right now day to day. I feel like the story is still unfolding in a crazy way, so I'm hoping that it will just be a nice complement to what questions people had from reading the first book, and sort of this story of what happens after foster care, what happens to these foster kids. And hopefully this will be a story of one foster kid that's not one of the traditional statistics.
Meaning you.
Meaning me, right.
But yes.
And I think my story and outcome really only exists because I finally found the permanency of an adopted family. And that only came about because I had volunteers and teachers and people who intervened in my life. So hopefully my story also acts as a call to action to ensure that other people are stepping forward to become foster parents and adoptive parents and guardian ad litem and mentors, because these children need voices now more than ever.
Well, before we get to Three More Words, which we will do very shortly, just for those of our listeners who don't know your story, we did say, you know, you had almost 10 years in foster care, 14 families, 14 placements, 10 schools, but just give us a little brief synopsis of Three Little Words, if you will.
Well, I spent almost 10 years in foster care, and, you know, during that time I had 14 different placements, and I later learned that almost 25% of my foster parents were or became convicted felons. Mm. So I was placed in homes with people who had problems with drugs, alcohol, violence, pedophilia. In one foster home, there were 16 kids sharing two bedrooms in a trailer, and we were beaten, starved, locked outside. It was a very high-profile case in Florida. And it was just this awful sort of upbringing.
Ashley, can I interrupt you for 1 second to ask you a question?
Sure.
What does this say about the screening and vetting process for vetting
foster parents.
And why would these people want to be foster parents?
Because they get paid.
Well, I know that, exactly. But it can't be that much. Yeah. It can't be that
much. Well, it is. I mean, sometimes teenagers, especially kids that are considered high risk or kids that are special needs, and in most cases, I think it's over the age of 8, you're automatically a special needs child just because of your age. And there are some agencies that pay as much as $1,200 a month per kid. So, I mean, crunch the numbers. You have 10-plus kids in the home and you have $1,000 per kid, and the money is not going to the children. It actually can be very lucrative for people who are not using the funds in the appropriate ways. And the sad reality is there aren't enough good homes. And we have problems with recruitment, we have problems with retention, and the really good foster parents, they get burnt out because the system is so overwhelming and so frustrating, and you kind of walk away scratching your head wondering how on earth these calls are being made, and it's sort of like we've lost there is no child in child welfare, and I think the really good dedicated caseworkers, the really good dedicated foster parents, they burn out really quickly, and so the homes that are left are the people who maybe don't do it for the right reasons, and they just kind of are happy having this revolving door of kids coming in and out. They don't make a lot of waves. They don't ask a lot of questions, and those are the homes that kind of stick around, and not all foster parents are this way. I mean, my husband and I became foster parents, and we've cared for over 20 children, so I know that there are good homes. There are good caseworkers. Unfortunately, in my case, I had some caseworkers that were arrested for falsifying records, arrested for for drug charges of various kinds. So, you know, it just takes this one bad apple in the casework system or the foster parenting, and then they do so much damage.
I remember you relating in the book about your little brother Luke being disciplined by somebody putting a foster parent putting hot sauce in his mouth or something like that.
Right. Well, he was maybe 5 in this home, and they strapped him into a high chair and poured hot sauce down his throat. But he was actually almost killed in that particular foster home. They tried to drown him. So it definitely was unbelievably traumatic. And it was at that foster home that I would go to school and I would tell my teachers and tell any adult that would listen to me what was going on in this foster home. Unfortunately, these foster parents actually taught foster parent training classes, if you can imagine. So they were just so ingrained in the community, and everyone thought that they were so wonderful for taking all these horrible kids that nobody wanted, and they would take the difficult children, and they really were seen as kind of these pillars in the community. And I was branded a liar and a troublemaker because when authorities would come out, all of the other kids were so terrified to admit what was really happening. So eventually I was thrown out of the home for causing too much trouble, and the abuse got worse after I left. They were threatening the children with guns, and they were beating them with boards that had nails in it. So,
are you talking about the Mosses?
The Mosses, yes. Yeah. This was the Moss foster home, okay. And that was the only foster home that I used their real names in the first book because it was such a high-profile case in Florida. When eventually, in my teenage years, I was 16, I'm sitting in the living room with my adopted parents, and we're watching the news because I was the super nerdy teenager that, you know, liked to watch the news. That was our family time. And so up on the screen popped these two mugshots, and they were the mugshots of the Mosses, who were my former foster parents. So they had been arrested on over 42 counts of felony child abuse with torture. And so finally there was evidence that somebody was listening to these kids, and I knew that they had so many children in and out of that home, and finally this was an opportunity to kind of come forward and share my version of the story, because a lot of these kids had tremendous psychological issues and were not doing well in school. They were juvenile delinquents, and they could be easily discredited, but my with the support of my adoptive family, we came forward and used my story to help bring some validity to the stories these other kids were telling.
Let me ask you, since your first book, Three Little Words, how much, if at all, have things changed within the foster care system in Florida?
Well, since I was a foster child, I was adopted in 98, and people look at my story and say, oh, your story was so many years ago. Oh, so many things are so much better. Oh, we're doing things completely differently. Well, our experiences as a foster parent sort of tell a very different story. And though we do have much better laws, much better policies in place since I was a foster child, the problem is that all of these laws are only as good as the people who are implementing them. So I was in care for 10 years, which is flat out illegal now. Unfortunately, it's still happening. One of the big Florida stories we had, you know, recently was Davion Only, the young man that he's actually from my area, went into church and he asked a family to adopt him. He had grown up in foster care. So these kids are still growing up in the system. And the pendulum has kind of swung way too far in the other direction. When I came into foster care, it was at the height of the crack epidemic in Florida, and they really were removing children at the smallest of slights. Well, now what I've been experiencing is that they're not removing children at all, and it's creating this surge in fatalities from either premature reunification, where they're sending children back into unstable environments and they're not properly rehabilitating these offending parents, or they're not removing these kids at all. And it sort of takes an unbelievable tragedy to get the system to want to intervene in these families, because the rights of the biological parents trump that of the safety and well-being of the children many times.
When you were in foster care, Ashley, when did you get the resolve to go forward and to do well?
Well, I think as a little kid, especially like in the moth home, I would sit around and I'd be like, man, this really kind of sucks. Like, who wants to live like this? You know, I didn't think it was right that kids were beaten or that I always felt hungry. You know, it was sort of this inner feeling of wanting to fight for injustice. And I'm, full disclosure, I am a redhead, so maybe I just kind of always had this little bit of fight about me. But I was also very lucky that I wasn't born with any disabilities. I don't have a cognitive deficit, so I'd always done really well in school. And school was kind of my sanctuary, because when I went to school, I wasn't beaten and I didn't go hungry, and I had wonderful teachers that were so encouraging. And I remember my fourth grade teacher gave me my very first book, which was Anne of Green Gables. So I'm reading this book, and of course I loved theater. That was a wonderful outlet for me. So I knew the story, you know, Little Orphan Annie. So I'm like, okay, what's with all these orphans with red hair and A names, you know? So that was just a tremendous outlet for me. And so the academic world has always been a wonderful space for me to thrive, and I think that helped tremendously.
Well, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to get to your new book. We're speaking with Ashley Rhodes Corder. She's an advocate and activist for adoption and a champion for the reformation of the foster care system. Her latest book is Three More Words. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Ashley Rhodes Corder. She's an advocate and activist for adoption and a champion for the reformation of the foster care system. She's delivered speeches on Capitol Hill. She's been invited to the White House, given keynote addresses at conferences about adoption and foster care, featured in numerous publications, and been on numerous media outlets. Her latest book is Three More Words. Ashley, I must tell you that it was shocking for me beyond words to read of the cases and abuse of many of the children you fostered. And I must say that I was unaware of the magnitude of the problem. Is one of your goals with your new book to expose the enormity and the scope of this problem? Because it's right, I mean, we're in Florida, and it's right under our noses. We read about cases sometimes that come to light in the newspaper, but so many of them go unreported.
Well, they do, and even though we do have an overwhelming number of children entering the foster care system or in foster care, you have to, frankly, be horrified at what happens when children aren't entering care. I mean, and we've been involved in cases where there have been babies who are born drug addicted, and they still get to go home with their offending parents who are still testing positive for drugs because of these new intervention laws and practices that are taking place around the state. And in Florida, there have been over 260 deaths reported to the Department of Children and Families this year. and many of them are under suspicious circumstances. This past February, one of our former foster children was returned to family that she had been removed from, and she was murdered by an uncle living in the home. So this 9-year-old little girl could have had a very different outcome if they had listened to the more than an entire year of professionals protesting this placement.
So where do things stand? You called her Millie in the book. What's her name, which you're now saying?
We called her Millie. Her real name was Jenica Randazzo. This, too, was a very sort of high-profile case, and that happened this year. So it actually happened as the book was in the final galley. So I was able to write about what unfolded after this happened. And, I mean, it was our worst fear as foster parents coming true. When I was initially writing the book, sort of our biggest heartache was the children that we, you know, sent back into unsafe situations, or, you know, we talked about the attachments that we made and then what happens when they moved on. But we never in our wildest dreams imagined that one of our kids would be murdered. I mean, it was just completely shocking. And I think it's also hopefully eye-opening for readers because these things are happening in our own backyards. You don't have to look at a third world country to see children who are hungry, who are horribly abused, malnourished. I mean, the cases like you described, the children that came into our home, your jaw just drops. We had a 2.5-year-old little girl who came to us with multiple STDs because she had been raped since infancy. We had another 4-year-old boy that was practically feral. He couldn't feed himself. He couldn't speak. You know, and these are children from our community, and they desperately need the stability of a loving family. And there's a lot of go ahead.
I'm sorry. This thing with Millie, what's her name, her actual name?
Jenica Randazzo.
Jenica, one of the things you said about Jenica is that you didn't want to let her story die. Well, there have been consequences, I understand, for you now that you brought up and pursued telling the truth about this story. And what are those consequences?
Well, when this happened, my husband and I, we were devastated. So even on our social media pages, we posted a picture about her and we sort of eulogized her and we talked about what a wonderful girl she had been. And in Florida, confidentiality laws change when a child dies. When a child dies, their case becomes a matter of public record. And my husband and I knew this, and we talked very openly about her and our experiences with her, mostly just to share what an incredible little girl this was, but that this tragedy absolutely could have been prevented. And there were files and warning signs, and we tried to contact the proper authorities to make sure they, when they did an investigation, they knew where to look, because we felt like we didn't want her story to be buried with her body. That's not fair. And we spoke out, and ultimately we were retaliated against by the agencies, and we were threatened and bullied and never once offered grief counseling or a kind shoulder at all. And ultimately we had to give back our foster care license because they served us with papers that would have acted as basically a gag order and would have had us admitting to breaking the law when we hadn't. And it said very clearly that if we didn't sign these documents, that would be grounds for them to revoke our license. So on paper, if they revoke your license, you may as well be a drug addict or, you know, a murderer or something. That's a pretty serious offense. So we really had no other recourse other than to give back our license temporarily. Mm-hmm. So currently, we can't foster children until we reengage that process. But it was just such a shame that they were more interested in protecting their own interests than telling the truth about what happened with this little girl and trying to move forward to prevent tragedies like this from happening in the future.
Did anything happen to her? I believe it was her mentally ill uncle that killed her with a tire iron.
Right. So she was, I mean, he first killed his mother and then beat her with a tire iron and then went after the siblings in the home. And I'm sort of following the case as anyone else, and it's still, you know, he's locked up, but it's an ongoing case.
Okay.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Also, email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Radio@wlrn.org. Actually, I was in the book, I was kind of struck by the fact that just listening to you, how well-spoken you are, and you've spoken all over the world, and obviously you have the ability to hold the attention of an audience in your many speaking engagements, that you had a flash that perhaps your mother, Lorraine, your birth mother was perhaps the genetic factor in that, because you heard her speak at an AA meeting.
Well, that too has been very interesting. So a lot of people are very curious, well, what happened with your birth family? And the story of my mom is so interesting. You know, she basically gave birth to me when she was a teenager, living in foster care herself. So it was just this vicious cycle. And she didn't have a support system. She didn't know what it was like to have a stable family life. And so we ended up in foster care. And while we were in foster care, she got involved with people who really didn't progress her life in a positive way. And I think she will have lifelong struggles with sobriety. But when she's sober, we've been able to maintain, you know, very healthy, productive relationships. And then when she's not, then I think she struggles as anyone else does with this sort of lifelong issue. But once, you know, I did go to visit her, and she was speaking at an AA meeting, and she was very poised and very compelling and was reaching out into her community, kind of owning her own story and her own addictions and using those to empower other people in the community. So that was very inspirational for me to see that she had those same abilities and that same instinct. And so I just really hope that she can maintain sobriety and a productive life.
Do you actually have memories of being taken by DCF at age 3?
It's all, the memory thing is really interesting. So in the first book, people are like, well, how can you possibly remember all of this stuff? Well, a lot of what happened in the first book, I have files upon files because of the lawsuits and what happened with the Mosses. All of my records were subpoenaed, so I had access to over 80,000 documents that made up my case file. So coupled with the very vivid memories that I do have from a little girl, and I think people tend to remember traumatic experiences much more so than anything. So I have these memories, but even the vague memories that I had, I was able to reinforce them with case files and interviews and police reports and firsthand interviews with the people that were involved. So that's how I was able to recreate a lot of the dialogue and a lot of very specific detail, because I have records and I have evidence of everything. And that was something that was so important to me, because my entire life I was told that I was a liar and that I just made all this stuff up. And I, in my adulthood, I wanted to be sure that everything I shared had evidence and proof and backup and documents to verify everything that I tell in these books.
Your first book, Three Little Words, what were the three little words?
Well, do we want her to say them yet? Because other guest. Yes.
Okay.
Well, I often joke that the three little words are read the book. I gave away the words on a radio show once, and I got so much hate mail because we are not a country of spoilers. People do not like to have the words spoiled. But everyone assumes that it's I love you, and that's definitely not what it is. It's, you know, Three Little Words is a very honest and open account of what it meant for me to be adopted and go through life with all these disappointments. And it really wasn't this rainbows and sunshine kind of occurrence. It was horrifying. And three more words is a little more predictable, and the words are actually I love you. And it's a whole journey of, you know, finding love, accepting love, and being able to give it back and going through that healing process.
Which brings up a good point, which is that even you, who did find a loving family, the Quarters, Gay and Phil Quarter, still through many, many years, Ashley, you suffered with an inability to show your love, to get close to people, to trust people. What does that say so much for these children that don't find the loving family? You know, I was so struck by that, because even with all the love that they gave you, you still really struggled with those issues of bonding, closeness, loving, and demonstrating it.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think even in the adoption process, I remember it was maybe 4 or 5 years after my adoption had been finalized, my mom was driving me to a basketball camp in Gainesville, which was like an hour and a half from our house. And so we had plenty of time to chat and, oh, you know, the whole mother-daughter chit-chat thing. So I asked her a question of, oh, well, if I did this, what would happen? If I did this, what would happen? Kind of testing my limits and boundaries and still feeling her out a little bit. And I said, oh, well, if I did such and such, would you send me back? So here it was, all of these years after my adoption had been legally finalized, I still had this notion that I could be sent back at any time. So it took me years to even believe that my adoptive parents were going to keep me forever. And there's an entire chapter in Three Little Words called Testing, Testing, where I pushed every button these people had. And finally, it got to the point where I was like, man, I can't get rid of these people. And so, right. You know, that's when the healing started, you know, really started to happen. And then I found that I did the same thing with my now husband. I spent years treating him really poorly and pushing him away. And it wasn't until many, many years of kind of dating and courtship that I was able to really embrace and accept his love. And, you know, I think perhaps it will be a lifelong struggle for me. And I'm lucky enough that I do have those stable foundations. But a lot of kids don't. Of the children in foster care nationally, 50% or less will graduate high school. 3% or less go on to get a bachelor's degree. So, I mean, those numbers alone show you the vulnerability of this population, especially when the cycle of abuse is so prevalent in their lives. I can't tell you the number of parents we dealt with our foster children, where they too were part of the system. So these kids grow up to become homeless or incarcerated or hooked on drugs, or they get into volatile relationships themselves, and it's just this hideous cycle that keeps repeating systemically and emotionally for these kids if they don't have that safe foundation or that one person in their life to intervene in a positive way, be it a mentor or a teacher or a volunteer, perhaps a guardian ad litem, an adoptive parent, foster parent, whatever that healthy relationship is, it makes all the difference in the world to these kids.
We're speaking with Ashley Rhodes Corder. She's an advocate and activist for adoption and a champion for the reformation of the foster care system, of which she was a part in Florida for many years. Her latest book is Three More Words. Another short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Monday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Ashley Rhodes Corder. Her latest book is Three More Words, which is a sequel to Three Little Words. And speaking of people important in Ashley's life, joining our program now with Ashley Rhodes Corder is longtime guardian ad litem Mary Miller. She's seen a great deal of the foster care system in the 22 years of volunteering in the role. One of her first cases was an advocate for both Ashley and her little brother Luke. Early on, she was aware of Ashley's resolve to help other kids, and she joins us now by phone from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome to you, Mary.
Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you, did you take a particular interest in Ashley, or were you just very diligent about your work? Was it Ashley, or was it your diligence, or both?
Well, Ashley is a remarkable young lady, even when she was little, 8 years old when I met her. And I was fortunate enough to have a wonderful foster family who was taking care of her brother that asked why Ashley and her brother were in the care so long. They had been in care for 5 years already and grown up. And she wondered why they didn't have an advocate like one of her other children did. So she personally asked me if I would become a guardian ad litem for her brother and Ashley. And that's how it all started.
And so tell us what happened with Ashley and how you actually freed her so that she could become adopted. What was the system that you had? What did you have to go through?
And this was
In Florida, correct. This is Florida. In the beginning, in the early 90s, the state of Florida had just really changed their ideas. Before that, it was almost impossible to remove children from their home permanently and terminate the parents' rights. But there had just been a program that had been started where they decided that some children, it was better to remove the children. And so Ashley's mom had been trying to work, as we call it, a case plan for over 5 years. And she would do little things like she might do a visit. but then she wouldn't visit for another 2 years. Or she might take a class in parenting, but then she would do nothing else. So all these things that were required, she might do a little bit, and then she'd not show up again for a very long time. And so that really meant that, you know, she really wasn't able to complete her case plan. And so there was no reason for these children to grow up in foster care.
So she kind of left the door open for all those years.
Right. And the system left the door open for all those years. Because the worker that I met when I first met Ashley, he kept saying, oh, well, she was here 2 years ago and saw her. Mm. And so there was all these little things. And unfortunately, even now, people realize that the system isn't perfect and it doesn't really do a great job of monitoring. And so they can get away with sometimes doing very little and still kind of retain the rights to their children and not ever have to really think about, you know, what this is doing to the child.
Are you also active in trying to enact changes, Mary?
Oh, I've been trying to do that for the last 22 years. And I did that in the state of Florida by becoming involved in lawsuits that involved Ashley and her brother. And we actually filed a class action lawsuit in the federal government. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't class action. That one was a civil rights lawsuit. And that one was because of the fact back then, and I'm not sure how it is now in Florida, that the state was mandated to keep people in mental hospitals and in jails safe, but there was nothing that was mandated to keep kids in foster care safe.
Ashley, I suppose that at the beginning, you probably didn't really think that Mary Miller would really give you all that much help.
Oh, not at all. So when I initially met Mary, I just saw her as one of a dozen faces coming in and out of my life. I had had so many people who said that they would do things but never did. I think by the time that Mary came along, I had had 8 foster mothers, my biological mother, and shifts of, you know, staff coming in and out of a group home that I had been living in. And though she was perfectly nice, like, I definitely didn't expect her to make a difference. And why should I? Because at that point, nobody else had. But behind the scenes, Mary was attending all of my mother's criminal trials. If my mother said that, oh, well, I've been working a job, the caseworker was inclined to say, oh, that's fabulous. Well, Mary said, no, I want to see some pay stubs. I want to see some evidence. If my mother said, oh, well, I've been working at Wendy's for the last 6 months, Mary would drive over to Wendy's and get a junior bacon cheeseburger to see what, you know what I mean? Like, she really was kind of an investigator slash advocate slash, you know, in my book, I describe her as being my Athena because she just really held people accountable, whether it was my mother, whether it was bad foster parents who were abusing me. It was because of Mary's advocacy that ultimately the Moss foster home was closed, and she was able to advocate for the children that had been abused in that home. And she, you know, told everybody that the Mosses had some sketchy things happening. And while everyone else was like, oh, no, these are wonderful parents, Mary is the one that brought forth the evidence and showed people what was really happening behind the scenes. And then to me, she would show up at my school for extracurricular activities that I was allowed to be involved in, which were kind of few and far between, depending on the, you know, the placement that I had. But it was like Mary was my own private fan club. And, you know, she just was this constant face, even though I was changing placements and changing schools. And I don't know why my regular caseworkers or foster parents weren't taking care of even my basic needs, but Mary made sure that I was, you know, keeping dental appointments and got haircuts and school supplies and was really this constant advocate for me. And again, behind the scenes, she was working on getting me legally free for adoption when everybody else kept wanting to give my mother more time. I was just rotting away in foster care. So it was really wonderful to have someone to help put some time limits on my future.
It strikes me how much you're like Mary as a guardian ad litem, which you also were in advocating and following up and investigating and checking. I'd like each of you, Mary and Ashley, to speak to those individuals that might be listening who are able to become guardian ad litems, but maybe they're not ready yet. What would you say to them?
Well, when I graduated, I'll be really quick, and then Mary can give a much more official answer than I. But when I graduated college, I became a guardian ad litem, and I was what struck me as being so interesting was that they're able to match you with cases that meet how much time you have, what your skill set is. And I had a wonderful supervisor that really held my hand throughout the process. So I was able to kind of blend my expertise and life experience into cases that really fit with my schedule. So I would encourage everyone to at least go through the classes and the trainings. It's free. It's fantastic information. It's so eye-opening to see what's happening in your own community. And there really is a caseload out there. I think the bare minimum requirement is like 3 hours a month. I mean, everybody has a few hours a month to help a child.
And I just want to say it's also called CASA, and other a court-appointed special advocate. Mary, you tell us what would you want to say to people that have the time and just feel like, well, maybe they are not ready yet?
I've been a big recruiter, and I have a number of my friends who say, oh, my gosh, I'm only doing this because of you over the years. But they find it very rewarding. And it's a situation you don't have to have any prior training. You don't have to have anything but maybe common sense, and that's what seems like maybe our system doesn't have. And you can make such a difference. The statistics say that if a child has an advocate, they're going to get out of care faster. They're going to be less damaged. They're going to have a brighter future. And all that with someone just allowing a child to come into their life and become the focus. And as a CASA, you investigate. You find out all the things, especially about a child. The worker is involved with the whole family, but a CASA involved with that child. She finds out what the child likes and what the child needs and just so many things specifically about that child that there isn't time for when you have maybe 40 cases or 50 cases, as the workers do. Mm-hmm. And you're independent. You don't work for the state, and so there's no dictate. And so when you go to the judge in the court hearings, he knows that you're doing that because you care about that child, and you're not trying to cover up something. You're not trying to do anything but make him aware of all the things that he needs to know to make the best decision in that child's life.
Getting back to Janica, I just want to, because she did die, do you know, either of you, how many deaths, or, well, you're in New Mexico now, Mary, but how many deaths have been reported this year in Florida's Department of Children and Families?
Over 260.
And I don't know that, but I do know that it's not something that's just in Florida. It's not something in any of the states. I mean, we've had so many children that have been murdered here while they're in care or when they've been sent back to their homes.
What can be done about this?
Well, I think we really need to be exploring a variety of permanency options for children. It seems like people are almost afraid of adoption right now, and I think that though we need to give families opportunities to stay together and stay intact, we also, at the same time, need to be looking at other permanency options. And there is no cookie-cutter way to deal with child welfare. Right now, it seems that everybody is ruling that biology is best. Siblings always have to stay together. But that's just not the case. We really need to have an individualized approach to these children because, like my brother and I, we had no business being in the same home together. It was just dangerous. And luckily, someone like Mary was able to advocate for our individual needs, and it led to a life-saving outcome for me. And I think we really need to be forcing the system to work on behalf of the best interest of these individual children instead of just assuming that all kids belong back to their parents. You know, children aren't property rights, and they shouldn't be treated as such. They really deserve their own rights, their own chance at a successful future, and that's only going to come when there's an advocate that's willing to speak for them, not for the family, not for bureaucracy, not for numbers, not for the agency that's incentivized by the number of children they reunify or just get off the books as quickly as possible. We really have to put the child back in child welfare.
That's the voice of Ashley Rhodes Corder. She's a champion for the reformation of the foster care system. Also with us, Mary Miller. She's a guardian ad litem and has been for over 22 years. Another short break, our last one. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're talking with Ashley Rhodes Corder. We've been mentioning her book, Three More Words, and also visiting is longtime guardian ad litem Mary Miller. She's joining us from Albuquerque. Ashley Rhodes Corder, with all of the time-consuming work that you had when you had your foster kids, it was kind of revolving doors, and these were mostly infants and toddlers who you're, of course, having to change.
And she was pregnant.
And feed, and pregnant, and had your own child at the time, and you decide to run for the Florida Senate. Now, maybe, how did that come about? Maybe you should be examined a little bit.
Well, perhaps. So, and at that time, I was also finishing my master's degree. So it was, I guess I could say that my life is never boring. I noticed that there wasn't anyone running in my area, and I felt like this was an interesting opportunity to, you know, bring to light some of these very serious issues in my local community. And it was such an interesting experience, and I'm glad that I did. And who knows, maybe one day I'll run again, because I'm always looking for opportunities to give voice to those who wouldn't otherwise have one. And so I'm eager to accept any opportunity that will allow me to talk about issues that not a lot of people know about, but that impact our society so greatly. And I think children certainly is one of those issues.
We have a listener on the line. This is Michelle. She's been waiting a long time. Thanks for your patience. Michelle in Pompano, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to say I'm in awe of your strength and your resilience. I'm amazed at your accomplishments, and congratulations for coming out of the situation you did. I think you sort of answered my question already. I was interested in adopting a girl, and she had a brother in the system. And we were very strenuously told that they really like to keep siblings together, and I was just wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Of course. I mean, systemically, they really do like to maintain sibling bonds. But the reality is, and my experience, is that some siblings really don't belong together. So I definitely think it's a shame when agencies deny children opportunities in this effort to, you know, maintain family bonds, when frankly, not all of those family bonds are healthy. So part of my advocacy efforts are to showcase multiple sides of the system. And again, there is no one solution where, you know, not all children belong back with their family, not all siblings belong together. So I really would hope that more agencies and workers take a stronger individualized approach to potential adoptions and outcomes for children.
And this is another thing that Guardian Ad Litem can help with. Because you really know the child, and you know how the relationships are with the siblings. You know how the relationships are with the parents. You really understand what's going on in the child's mind. And so you can certainly help in this, in advocating or not advocating if they want to take the children apart for keeping them or allowing the siblings to be adopted separately.
And that was a decision that Mary was able to identify in our story, that my brother and I had vastly different needs. And luckily, we had someone step forward to say, look, I think they're going to have a better shot separately. And that was certainly the case.
Well, and you also had that little girl, Lillian. I believe her two brothers were very abusive to her and to each other.
Exactly. So as our experience as foster parents, we had very large sibling groups, but the siblings were perping on each other. But they kept insisting on trying to put these siblings together when the elder siblings were raping the younger siblings. There's nothing safe or okay about that. But on paper, it sounds so wonderful. Yes, of course we have to keep siblings together. But you really, I mean, that should be the role of a caseworker or a guardian, is to think about all of these other scenarios. And in these situations, just time and time again, we've seen cases where it is not in the best interest, or it's not even safe to have siblings or families together. Or, unfortunately, it was rare for us to have a large sibling group where they even had the same father, or there would be a 15-year-old and a 1-year-old, and they had never even met because the 15-year-old had grown up. So it's like, well, how strong are those sibling bonds? So do you have the 1-year-old bouncing around in foster care under the guise of getting to know the older sister, who now by then is a juvenile offender? You know, these are very complicated, complex situations. And so if we just get back to focusing on an individual child, then, you know, maybe their outcomes will be better.
And we'll move along to another listener. This is Lillian in Delray. We're short on time, Lillian. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I to me that the foster care system hasn't changed too much. It still seems to be very much of a problem. I know when my three brothers and my other sister, we were all placed in foster care, we were all separated, just the two boys stayed together. But today, as adults, we are so much stronger. Our bond is so strong. Even though we grew up without each other, it was something that we yearned to be together. My mother was a severe alcoholic, and my dad died as we were young children. And it was a cycle. She tried to go to AA, would get better, and then as soon as we were ready to come home, boom, there it was. She wasn't able to take us back because they would find her in the apartment drunk that mm-hmm. she had gotten ready for us. It was really a sad cycle that just kept on going over and over again.
Any comment, Ashley?
Well, yeah, so this would be a great opportunity to talk to all of the children in the case, and this caller would be able to say, I am very close to my siblings, and if workers talk to the children, find out their specific needs, and in that situation, absolutely, we should fight to keep these siblings together. And also, relationships change as people get older. To this day, I probably won't be close with my brother because he's a felon many times over, and that's not safe for me or my children. But I do have a relationship with other members of my biological family that are either sober or they never had other issues, and I'm just now becoming acquainted with them. So relationships do change over time. It's just imperative that you always involve people in your life who will progress it in a positive way and help you grow and help you heal and help you become a productive member of society.
I don't want us to go, Ashley, without mentioning, because we mentioned the Corders, who were so important in your life, and we mentioned Lorraine, your biological mom. Now we mentioned Luke, your brother. But we can't let you go without talking about Eric, who seems to be, I can't let you go anyway, a saint on earth. And well, you did mention how you put him through the hoops, those hoops, and tested him to make sure that he would stay with you no matter what. But what has he meant to you in your life?
Well, Eric is my husband, and he has just been this amazing touchstone and so I know that's so cliche, my rock, but he's just an amazing father and an amazing human being. And I think I was lucky again to have the adopted family that I did because it gave me a framework for what a marriage is and to have a man who lets me thrive and lets me shine. And it's okay being a stay-at-home dad right now and taking care of the kids. And our foster kids were constantly just in total awe of him because they had never met a man who doesn't yell or hit women or drink excessively. You know, he's just super kind and mellow and go with the flow. I mean, the kids were just shocked by him. They didn't even know what to do with such a kind but strong male figure. So it's just been amazing, and I've been able to have this incredible life because I have such a supportive partner, I have supportive parents. Mary Miller, my former guardian ad litem, is still a part of my life, and that's really, I think, the key to my success is just surrounding myself with this amazing support system, and that's the kind of support system that I wish for all children who grow up in foster care or anyone who experiences an adversity of their own.
Well, I wish we had more time, and we don't have time, but I am going to give out this website. Your nonprofit is the Foundation for Sustainable Families, and the website is sustainablefamiliesfoundation.org. So people can find out more. Also, your website, Ashley?
Is roads-corder.com, roades-corter.com. Please feel free to write with any other questions that you might have, or if you're interested in about fostering or adopting or becoming a guardian, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, or feel free to say hello on social media.
That's
and
great.
Mary Miller,
thank you very much for being with us and for all your great work that you've done.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ashley Rhodes-Corder's latest book is Three More Words. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in this hour. Remember, if you'd like to hear more of the program or have someone who'd gain by listening, we have free audio archives and downloads at the website wlrn.org. Check us out as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. We'll have links and photos there. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction provided by online producer Paul Leary. Join us for tomorrow's program. We discuss LGBT issues. What sort of constitutional questions lie ahead after last month's Supreme Court same-sex marriage decision? We'll have a panel on hand and, of course, take your call. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.